blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see.
You are listening to CFRO 102.7 FM. This is Animal Voices. My name is Marge Adams, and in the studio with me are co-host Carl Loskin, technician John Pranger, and we have a visitor today. Her name is Kelly Harris. Thank you for coming in, Kelly. In the next hour, Carl will be speaking with an author, Penelope Smith. Carl, maybe you could tell us a little bit about that interview.
Yes, Penelope Smith has been the founding pioneer for a field whose name she originated, and it's called interspecies telepathic communication. More about that soon.
Sounds interesting. Later, I'll be interviewing Olga Betts, who is the founder and president of a local organization called Vancouver Rabbit Rescue and Advocacy. Olga has a profound knowledge of companion rabbits, which she will be sharing with us. Now, Carl, I think you have a few thoughts to express.
Well, we always so much appreciate what Howard Lyman writes, and he wrote in his book, his latest book called No More Bull, he wrote, "We can't allow ourselves to simply bemoan the media that and they have been bought and co-opted by special interests. Yes, we know that. We must harness the media. Yes, we must harness the media for ourselves and create whatever outlets we can. If we truly believe what we say about the damage to our collective health and our shared environment that results from the animal-based diet, then we have a positive duty to make our case in as dramatic a fashion as possible. No statistic makes as powerful a case as the image of a slaughterhouse. We need to find ways to bring the reality of the slaughterhouse to the airwaves and the internet. The internet in particular offers a low-cost means of exposing people, especially young people, to the harsh realities of food production in North America. All North Americans, including school-age children, should see what a slaughterhouse looks like so that they can know what they are eating, and they need to do that in order to be able to make a informed choice about their food." That's Howard Lyman from his book, No More Bull. Well, you know, Marge, I came across a very interesting idea. You know, when you walk past the meat counters, and the meat always looks really nice and red.
Yeah.
And have you noticed?
I've noticed.
Well,
yeah.
You know, in many cases, it's artificial. And this is something that was reported in ABC News in the United States. And it says, "You can't judge a piece of meat by its reddish-pink cover." Because they use the meat's color as a guideline to determine the food's freshness. That's what most people do. But many meat manufacturers actually inject the food with carbon monoxide to give it that fresh reddish pink look. Japan and Canada, hey, thanks Canada, along with many other countries in Europe, have banned the use of carbon monoxide in meat. Lawmakers are debating whether the producers should be allowed to continue the process in the United States. While the Food and Drug Administration has said that the practice isn't dangerous, some customers disagree. At worst, it's dangerous. At best, it's a consumer ripoff. And that was published in, it was read out in ABC News.
Oh, that's pretty frightening. Well, I wouldn't want to be swallowing carbon monoxide or whatever is the residual of the carbon monoxide. It just sounds a little scary.
It always intrigues me how dark red the steaks that are displayed, and of course the beef, mm-hmm. the ground beef as well. Well, you know, what we saw last week in the news was the Japanese whalers went to the Antarctic. And this was last week on November the 18th. Japan launched its whaling fleet for the Southern Ocean Sanctuary around Antarctica, where it plans to kill more than 1,000 whales over the next several months. Including what they will kill is some 50 endangered humpback whales. This will be the first time that humpbacks, the singers of the sea as they're called, have been hunted industrially since the mid-1960s. Their population has dwindled by an estimated 90% in a severely endangered before, and they were so endangered that it was banned to kill these humpback whales. But now, of course, the fleet is off to the Antarctica again.
We have Penelope on the line now.
Yes, we do. And communicating with animals throughout her life, Penelope Smith discovered in 1971 that animals could be relieved of emotional traumas and other problems through the same counseling techniques that helped humans. She has a bachelor's and master's degree in the social sciences and years of experience in human counseling, nutrition, and holistic body energy balancing methods. And she has a first-hand education with animals, and she has as we've mentioned earlier, she's the founding pioneer for a field whose name she originated. It's called interspecies telepathic communication. Welcome to Animal Voices, Penelope Smith.
Thank you.
Yes, and maybe you can just explain to us what do you mean by this interspecies telepathic communication?
Sure. Telepathic communication is something that is behind all other forms of communication, our human languages and animal languages. And telepathy comes from the words tele, which means distance, as in telephone, and pathy, which means feeling. So it really means being able to feel across a distance, being able to feel another. And we're all born with the ability, even before we learn to speak, to feel other beings and to actually experience their energies, their emotions, and even their thoughts. So this is something common to all species. Unfortunately, in the human species, in our culture, most people are socialized out of the ability to telepathically communicate by people saying that it doesn't really exist and that human language is the only valid form of communication.
So how do you communicate with animals?
Well, in contacting an animal and being with them, I am usually called to ask questions and find out things about animals for their people, for their guardians. And what I would do is be open to receive. Telepathic communication, again, is sort of like finer-tuned sensing. And so I can actually be aware of the animal and open up to the animal to their feelings, to what they're experiencing, and it comes across to me visually. It can come across as mental pictures, but also I can experience how they smell, how they touch, how they taste, how they feel the world. So if I asked an animal, what did you do today while your person was at work, I might receive pictures and also sensations of the animal running in their yard and what they smelled and what they touched and what they tasted. And this is something that I've cultivated, but that all of us have, no matter how many years of socialization and rust has accumulated on the ability.
Now, it needs keen observation to not only observe the animal, and they also give messages other than telepathic, don't they? Like put out their paw or a certain thing,
or
maybe a look even.
Sure, there's all kinds of communication that animals have, and they even have their own languages, their own signs. Bees do dances, elephants draw artistic designs in the sand, and communicate with low rumbles that we can't even hear over vast distances. And all those physical forms of communication are obviously valid to those who understand them. And behind all this, whether you're in the presence of the animal or not, you don't have to observe them to telepathically communicate, because telepathic communication is not dependent on distance. You just need to know who you're talking to. You need to have some connection with them. And you can actually receive across the distance these fine-tuned waves or energies or vibrations that from animals, from people, from all living beings that are telepathic.
Now,
so I could get, even at a distance, what an animal was feeling if I was asked to communicate with them.
Now, one would think that most, like we communicate with each other, humans, but most people at some level can communicate. But you've developed this as a skill far above and beyond what most people can do. So maybe you can tell us how you developed these skills. Would you think it was a natural thing, or if people wanting to develop a greater skills at communicating with animals, what would you recommend they do?
Yeah. Well, first, in my own particular case, like everybody else, I was born with this ability. However, I didn't let people stop me when they told me it was all my imagination. I just continued because I valued animals as friends very much, and I didn't want to put them down and say, no, you can't communicate, no, you're stupid, like everybody thinks. In fact, I just kept it in the background, and then when I, later on in my life, as I became a counselor for people, I started finding that the techniques that worked with people also worked fantastically with animals. But normally what happens to people is they're made fun of if they say that the dog is feeling this, or he's got a tummy ache, and they're sensing those things from the dog, or they have conversations with birds or whatever, and they're made fun of. And so humans, being very social animals, want to be like other humans who mean a lot to them, particularly their parents and their peers, and so they start to deny the ability, and then it disappears. It atrophies. So for people who want to start to open up to it again and reclaim their connection with all of life and their ability to understand other beings as fellow beings, first of all, it requires a change in attitude, the attitude that animals are less than us, are stupid, are not intelligent, gets in the way. And when you start to regard animals as fellow beings with different kinds of intelligence that is appropriate for their role on the earth in the web of life, and you start to be open to learn from animals, then people start to realize that, especially people that love animals and are close to animals, that they have gotten telepathic communication. They have picked up their animals' feelings and intentions. But they didn't know what to call it, and they didn't know how to develop it because, again, very little in our society encourages this ability. So first of all, starting to recognize what it is. An example would be a person suddenly feels like they have to go out to the barn. They don't know why, but they just feel pulled to go out to the barn, and they go there, and they find that the horse is caught underneath the corral, caught in the fence. And what they were receiving was a sort of an urgent feeling, and they were getting that from the horse. They were feeling that sense of something wrong. And so people start to realize, oh, yeah, I do have that ability. And it is an aspect, telepathic communication is an aspect of intuition, being able to feel, being able to trust our feelings, developing the ability to get feelings and go by them. And so what happens is the results show for themselves. People often question, well, how will I know it's not just my own thinking? I said, well, the animals will show you. They respond very positively to telepathic communication when they are understood and it's not just your mental projections or your presuppositions. When you really are getting animals' communication, they really respond positively, they cooperate more, and problems are solved. It's quite an miraculous thing, and with many applications and a great deal of help to us who relate to animals, both domesticated animals and wild animals.
Now, in your webpage, animaltalk.net, and we'll try and repeat that a number of times, animaltalk.net, which is really worthwhile having a look at, you also counsel people who would phone you. I mean, you don't even see the animal. And
yes.
The animals are communicating. You're the medium.
Yes. And this
That's
is
amazing.
What I say about telepathic communication is it's not dependent on distance. You don't have to be right there with the animal. When you hook up with an animal that you know through the person, like a person calls and they say, I've got a problem with my dog, and then I usually would ask for a description of the dog and where they are, it's like getting the right phone number. Suddenly you're in connection with the animal like you are with a person when you call them up. And they are aware of their connection with you, and you can tell that this is happening because the animals show you. You know, they actually visibly change during a consultation, during the communication, and the results happen, both from communicating with the person and with the animal.
Yes, so you do that. I lost my train of thought here. To able to communicate, and but you had some stories, a wonderful story on your webpage about there was a feral cat that used to, a wild cat, and then it wasn't there, and then you would mentally tell the cat you wanted to see her, and then the cat came. Maybe you can tell that story.
Well, I don't exactly remember that story, but I can tell you a story that it's brought up that is related to feral cats. I've been called upon to help with cats that people have a program where they trap the cats, neuter them, and then return them, feral cats who can't be socialized or don't want to live with people because they're raised wild, out in the wild. And one time this man called me because this one cat would never get into the trap, or she'd get the food and race out of the trap before the door came down. And he tried for years, and she was having litter after litter. And, of course, then it's a problem of overpopulation and no homes for the cats and no place for the cats and cats getting hurt and all that. So I communicated to the cat. She was very afraid that she was going to be killed. So I showed her what the man was going to do, that he was actually going to help her, and that even though she would have to go to a veterinarian, and I explained that to her, what that would involve, and she would have an operation, she would feel much better afterwards because she would no longer have to have the stress of having litter after litter after litter and her own health going down and her own safety. And when I explained that to her, I said, no, he is to be trusted. And he'll only keep you for as long as you heal, and then he's going to release you. That night, she walked into the trap after not having captured her for trying for 2 years, and that was because of the communication and really listening to her fears, which she was, again, terrified of being killed by people, and really understanding what was going on with her, and then explaining to her what was really going to happen. And so that's the results of telepathic communication. It's pretty pretty remarkable and obviously very, very useful.
Now, that's a wonderful story. But are some animals more adept at communicating, or do they all? I mean, how does that go?
They all communicate differently because they're individuals. Both they're different as species. Telepathic communication is universal, so whether you're communicating to an elephant or a snail, they all can communicate their feelings to you. However, different animals will communicate differently. Like, I've had some horses in a barn who just answer very quickly, don't have too much to, that they want to say. And then other horses in the barn who want to tell you everything about everybody in the barn. They're like the local gossip. So they are all different, just like people are different. Some people are quieter. Some people like to communicate a lot or only about certain things. Animals are like that, too.
Now, you... Sorry.
Go ahead.
No. Well, you know, I want to change the subject just slightly.
Yeah.
Is because you counseled humans and their companion animals, but many people go through the experience of grieving for their animals when they move on. And how do you do that?
Well, it is possible to communicate to animals as after they have left the earth, after they have died. Because they are spiritual beings just like you and me. My book, Animals and Spirit, which is coming out in January, goes into the whole subject of how to communicate with animals after death, what they experience on dying, what they experience with their people, what they want us to know, what messages they have for us after death, and also how we can get in touch with them, how we don't lose touch. They're always... in our hearts and in our souls, if we can communicate with them. Learning how to communicate with animals, even after death, can make our transition with them and our heartache a lot easier to bear.
So this of course, raises the issue of, you know, the afterlife, which I find so acceptable, because if we believe that humans have an afterlife and the animals are in spirit so much as we are, why shouldn't they also have an afterlife? And then many people would say, well, do you believe in reincarnation? But when I hear you speak now, the evidence of communication and their likeness to many of the more sensitive issues that we can raise ourselves to, and it becomes so obvious. And in your book, Animals in Spirit, and thank you, for some reason I have a copy of it, and it's a wonderful book, and I think you're going to have great success with it. But maybe you can just say a little bit about Animals in Spirit and your webpage, animaltalk.net.
Yes, I have been communicating with animals all my life, and professionally I started over 3 decades ago to start to teach people how to do it themselves, and I've written books, Animal Talk, When Animals Speak, and now Animals in Spirit, and I have many, many publications and tools for people to learn how to open themselves and understand them and the animals themselves on my website, animaltalk.net. And Animals in Spirit is coming out in January, and it's a book that is designed to really help people with this sensitive subject of their animals dying and what the animals feel and how that we can help them in the transition and how we can help ourselves to stay connected and have a heartwarming experience of them after death instead of the continual loss and pain.
It's that in your book you write that the spirits of animals and all beings are made up of love, and we're connected by this love, which many people say the universe was created by an act of love, and so we're all connected.
Yes, it seems to be the universal substance that connects us all, and I think that quantum physics is studying this particle that's behind everything, and they're actually meeting up with the philosophies of old in that they're finding that this is this God particle or divine love or whatever you want to call it is the creative source of everything, and that we're all made of it.
How wonderful. I have a personal experience question to ask you. As we had 2 cats, and the one cat passed away, and then we buried the cat in our garden, and then before we put it in the ground, we brought the other cat to see that Ricky was no longer there, and when she sniffed at Ricky, and she just jumped up in the sky.
Yeah.
I mean, she was quite. I don't know what it meant. Maybe you can tell me. What do they go through?
It's a startling thing for animals, too, to lose their friends. And many animals have a grief response, and it's a shock to them. They, just like it is for us, it's hard to believe that that body that was alive with our friend there with us is now dead. And I've seen animals have various responses. Some will... it hurts too much for them to look, and they'll just turn away. Others will be startled, like, what is that? How could that be? Which I got from your cat. She was just really startled. And others will just sit by the body and just grieve. So they each have their way. I've had many experiences over the years with my own animal family of various responses. Some of my animal friends will say goodbye, and it's real obvious they're saying goodbye and lie down next to the other dog or cat as they're dying, and then have nothing to do with them after that. They've said goodbye, and they don't even want to see the body after death.
Another experience where one of our programmers here on Co-op Radio, she passed away last year, and she had a little dog called Spunky. And when we were standing around outside where the funeral, where the casket was going to be lowered, and the dog was just shivering and shaking and uncontrollably. And then they took the dog, such an emotional moment for me, took the dog to her casket, she sniffed around, you know, she stopped shivering and shaking.
Yeah.
And Marge has a question for you, my co-host. Oh,
I just wanted to know if there was any optimum age to start this communication. Now, I have a cat who is about 12 years old.
It doesn't matter as far as the animal's age?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what I was saying.
It doesn't matter. You can communicate with them when they're babies. Uh-huh. It doesn't matter. We're spirits always. We always can communicate telepathically. So it doesn't matter if you're have died or if you're just new in a body. You certainly can communicate with your little kitten who you've just gotten, or a dog, or whoever. It doesn't matter what age. There is no, you know, they'll have a different experience in the body, just like babies do of any age, and obviously different neurological development. But they can communicate about who they are, what they want, why they're here, all kinds of things you can ask them.
I must open up this communication with my Bella.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Thank you.
You'll love it.
Well, Penelope Smith, it's been a great privilege to be with you for this short time, and there's so much more. And your wonderful voice, your webpage is animaltalk.net, and you have... you've been a pioneer in so many ways in making people understand their animals through this interspecies telepathic communication. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us today.
You're very welcome.
Bye for now.
Goodbye.
And yes, you're listening to Co-op Radio, coming out to you on 102.7 FM. It's your favorite animal program, Animal Voices. Our webpage is animalvoices.org, and many of our programs are posted on the internet, animalvoices.org. Over to you, Marge.
Thank you, Carl. And we now have our next guest on the line. Her name is Olga Betts, and Olga is the president and founder of Vancouver Rabbit Rescue and Advocacy, which is a registered charity, and it's a chapter of the international organization House Rabbit Society. Hello, Olga.
Hello.
Welcome to Animal Voices.
Thank you.
Olga, maybe we could start with getting a little information about your organization. Would you please give us some background on this?
Vancouver Rabbit Rescue and Advocacy was founded in 2003. I was interested in rabbits before that, and then we got the organization going. We are a registered charity. We exist on donations and the money that comes in from our little rabbit supply store. We sell all kinds of nice things for bunnies.
Is that done mainly through the internet?
People can see about it on the internet, and then they can come and pick it up once they get in touch with us. Our website is vrra.org.
That's easy.
and Vancouver Rabbit Rescue and Advocacy, VRRA, and they can see all about the things on the internet that we sell, and that helps bring in money. And we rescue rabbits that are abandoned or neglected are generally unwanted. We also work with a local SPCA shelter, mostly the Vancouver one. Some of the other ones, they have rabbits that have medical problems or things that, some of them that are considered unadoptable, we take them in and look after them and make sure they're okay.
And your group is entirely volunteer, I believe, isn't it?
Yes.
I bet you're kept pretty busy.
Yes, we don't have any paid staff, and we do need volunteers all the time for various different things.
Now, you say you work with the SPCA. Does that mean that they would refer rabbits to you if they had them in their shelter?
Yeah, they sometimes do. The SPCA hospital sometimes calls me up, and I take rabbits that have medical care needs or ones that are found, you know, injured and abandoned. We also volunteer at the shelter to help with rabbit adoptions and the cleaning, feeding of the bunnies there. And we're happy to do it. We like working with the SPCA to do the best we can with their rabbits, too.
And there are an abundance of rabbits, aren't there, in the greater Vancouver area?
Yes. There's way too many sold in pet stores as baby rabbits. And as you can understand, it's an impulse purchase of this cute little thing. Unfortunately, often for children, and they are not good pets for children.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the child's tired of them and the parents realize how much work they are, they throw them out in the park.
Yeah.
They think that because they see a lot of other little rabbits running around there, that the rabbit will have a nice little life out there with its friends, and nothing could be further from the truth.
Well, now, what does happen to those rabbits? And I understand there are a lot of them in Richmond area. What can they survive out there?
Well, some of them survive, just like any animal, I guess. There's the hardy, lucky ones.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them will perish very quickly. A domestic animal of any kind is really not very good at avoiding predators and finding food on their own. And rabbits live in large groups, but they're kind of known groups. And if you throw a new rabbit in, it's going to be attacked by the resident rabbit, so he might be injured right away.
And their only defense, I suppose, is speed, isn't it?
Running, and they do fight. They fight very viciously, like cats do at times.
Oh, and now, what would be a predator?
Raccoons, coyotes, feral cats, or even just large predatory-type cats. Dogs, of course.
Okay.
Horrible people take their dog especially over to the park where there are rabbits so it can chase them because that's fun for the dog.
Oh. Most of those animals are bigger than the rabbit, aren't they? And it's probably stronger by thinking of the raccoon and the coyote.
Raccoons and coyotes are really good at getting rabbits. And
yeah.
People don't think of raccoons that way, but they're actually quite vicious.
Yeah. So the sheltering is a large part of your work then, and rescuing.
Yes.
Now, when you go out to rescue a rabbit, tell me about it. How do you do that?
Well, we don't do a lot of that because it would be, well, we'd have hundreds and hundreds of them.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But we do, when I do go out to get them, and I do occasionally in certain circumstances, you usually take something to contain the rabbit. And most of the ones we get are the kind of poor little animals that have just been stuck there. And you can usually just walk up and pick them up.
Oh,
they're completely stunned, like, where am I? And, you know, they're hovering there, wondering what to do next. The odd ferals, I've never really trapped a feral. The ones that are born in the wild, it's very sad, but the best thing we can do really is just leave them there. They then become kind of like a wild animal.
And they are prey animals,
aren't
they?
Yeah, and things eat them, but I mean that
happens in nature, doesn't it?
Exactly. If they were wild rabbits, the same thing would be, real wild rabbits, the same thing would be happening. But if they're newly thrown out and somebody alerts us to that fact, we will get them if we can, especially if the people can get them themselves, and even more if the people can keep them for us.
Ah, yes.
We can help them find a home and get the rabbit neutered or spayed, but we don't. Having the room for them is the hardest thing.
And so you do use foster homes then?
We do if we can. It isn't easy to find foster homes, so we need foster homes for that situation, but even more for situations where we have an old bunny, for instance, and nobody's really going to want to adopt them.
Ah, yes.
But we want to look after them, and so it would be nice if somebody would foster that bunny for the last years of their life, and we will pick up the medical care, and they can have the bunny kind of like their bunny. Except that they're fostering them for us and giving them a place to be rather than sitting in a shelter.
Yes. Now, when a lot of people buy these, most of them originally, I guess, do come from pet stores, don't they?
Most of them, most of the ones that are rejected do. There aren't that many people who get one from a rescue and then don't want it anymore, although, of course, that does happen no matter how careful you are.
Yeah.
There's always that unforeseen circumstance. I had a very tragic circumstance with a woman who lost her sister and her husband back in another province. They were killed in an auto accident, and she had to take in their children, and their children were deathly allergic to animals.
Oh.
So it was kind of one of those situations where there wasn't anything else she could do.
I see.
That kind of thing, you know, happens, but most of the people who abandon rabbits got them when they were little babies in pet stores and for the wrong reasons and without knowing enough information.
That's a big problem, I think. People don't understand that, what the requirements of a rabbit and the behavior, and they sort of impulsively, particularly at Easter time, go out and buy a rabbit, maybe even for a friend, without getting their permission in the beginning, and it makes a terrible situation for the animal.
Yes, well, I recently had a woman call me up wanting to give up her rabbit because the grandparents had brought her son a rabbit without asking them at all, and everyone in the family is allergic to it, and so now what's going to happen to this poor little rabbit?
Yeah.
And the grandparents were, I mean, why on earth did they do something so foolish?
Yeah,
you know, it's just not, you don't buy someone, it's not a thing, you don't buy people a pet and give it to them without consultation
and planning.
Like research.
Yeah. And all kinds of things. What is the typical lifespan of a rabbit?
Rabbits can live to be 12, 14, 15 years old if they're really lucky and you know, they have good genes and you feed them well. But the typical age is 10 to 8, 8 to 10.
Oh, yeah. So it's a long-term commitment, isn't it, when you get a rabbit?
Yeah, they are, and a lot of people, even a child 11 or 12, you know, which they think is perfectly capable of looking after a rabbit. They really are adult pets, but that child is going to be 22, 21 when the rabbit's old, and of course they're going to go through a lot of changes, university, boyfriends, girlfriends, you know, different hobbies, and it's unlikely that they're going to remain interested all that time in diligently caring for a rabbit every day.
Very unlikely. I mean, even with dogs and cats, that's a problem. The mother usually ends up looking after the animal. I've recognized.
every pet. We don't want any pet to go anywhere where the woman in the house, in particular, doesn't want the animal, or even especially the dads these days too. Because there's a lot of dads who are really not keen on the pet, and it always ends up not being good because then the slightest thing goes wrong and then they don't want the rabbit in the house. And if it's a family situation, then everybody has to be happy with the pet.
Right. Now, are there many different breeds of rabbits locally?
There are lots of different breeds, but we don't really. As a House Rabbit Society chapter, we're not really into breeds so much because people get hung up on whether it's a Netherland Dwarf or a Holland Lop. And rabbits are rabbits. They're kind of like cats, really.
Are they pretty much similar in behavior and so on?
Yeah, every rabbit needs the same kind of attention and care. Doesn't matter what kind it is. And they can all be, any breed can be shy, any breed can be aggressive, any breed can be outgoing.
Sure.
So it's just whichever personality rabbit goes along with you and what appeals to you, perhaps. It doesn't really matter size, age, type.
Now, I've known rabbits years ago that were kept in a little rabbit hutches. Now, that just doesn't seem to be acceptable at all, to put them in a cage. That's not the way they want to live, I'm sure.
Most people have some sort of containment for their bunny when they're not around. Mm-hmm. It can be, you know, as long as it's an adequate size and the rabbit doesn't actually live in it, it's okay. But they can't. They're just like you wouldn't shut your dog or your cat in a, well, you know, I guess there are those people that chain a dog in the backyard its whole life, but that's obviously not what you're supposed to do with an animal. And the same with a bunny. They can't live their life in a cage.
No.
They're wonderful free because they race and dance and leap for joy, and if you have them shut up in some small container, you never see that happen.
It must be terrible to, for the animal. You need to have a well-fenced yard, I guess, don't you?
If you're going to let them out in the garden, they should always be supervised. Either that or you have a very well-protected space, top, bottom, sides. Even crows will attack rabbits at times, so you need an over-the-top covering. You need a floor covering because they'll dig out, they'll tunnel.
Oh, yes.
They tunnel very well.
Yes.
And things can tunnel in, too.
Yeah.
The coyote will dig right under, given a chance.
Oh, yes. I can imagine that.
They would have to have a secure area in the garden, but they love to... Just like your dog or cat likes to go out and play, they love to go out and play.
Are they pretty much home buddies or not, generally?
Yes.
And like cats and dogs, well, they're, you know, like I have a cat and I let her out whenever she wants to go, but she doesn't go outside the yard. She doesn't seem to want to. Of course, she's a mature cat by this time.
That's true. The rabbit should always be neutered or spayed, of course, because just like any other animal, they reproduce and they also are much less aggressive, and their urine doesn't smell as much, and they don't dig and chew as much. Their hormones are more settled, and so if you have an unneutered male or female, it might leave its territory seeking another rabbit.
Yes.
But a neutered male or female is very unlikely to leave their territory. When people say, our rabbit ran away, no, it didn't. What happened was something happened to it, or someone took it, or...
Oh, yes.
Something killed it, because rabbits are very territorial, and they know their territory, and they don't like to go beyond their territory.
I see. Oh, that's a good characteristic for a companion animal, isn't it? Now, you mentioned that they're somewhat like cats, but there are differences, aren't there, in their behavior and their response and so on.
Yeah, bunnies are they live in large groups like dogs do, so in some ways they're more... They're small and furry, kind of more like cats, but their behavior is a little more pack-like. They really like social... They love to be petted and talked to and to be around people, and it's really nice to have a pair of rabbits because they cuddle together and groom one another and follow each other around. And it's...
Are they cuddly?
They're not cuddly in the way that people want them to be, like the pick-up and cuddle pet. They really prefer to stay on the ground. Yeah, but they will come, if you sit on the floor, they'll come to you and they'll even climb up on you lots of times. And that's what they prefer to be being picked up, because when they're, as a prey animal, when you pick them up, it means, uh-oh, something's going to eat me.
Oh, yes, of course.
You know, like they're not a, like cats, cats, you can sweep them up into your arms, and they generally, I used to have my cat on my shoulders a lot.
Oh, yes.
He'd like to sit up there, but... Bunnies, they like to have their little four feet on the floor.
Oh, yes. I guess that's their main defense, is get out of the way of some critters coming down at them from the sky or from behind or anything
else.
Yes,
and there are rabbits that tolerate being picked up, and they'll be held, and but I think they much prefer to hop up beside you. Like, mine will hop up beside us on the couch and sit on your... sit right beside you and be petted for hours.
Really? Yeah. Tell me about house training.
They'll use a litter box like a cat.
Okay.
And it isn't difficult to train them. And they are like any other animal. They might have an accident here and there, but mine run around my house and they use the litter box diligently. Occasionally rabbits will leave a few little droppings around. That's not that uncommon, but the droppings are very small and hard and you just pick them up. They're not smelly or messy.
I see.
Especially, again, the rabbit has to be neutered or spayed. If they're not, and this is why a lot of them get thrown out. When they reach puberty, they start to mark their territory with feces and urine in order to attract another rabbit.
And they do it. They multiply very quickly, don't they?
Yeah. They breed once a month.
Now, they don't tolerate aloneness very well, do they?
No, a rabbit alone is kind of a sad thing. Like, it's why it's so awful for them to be shut in some outdoor hutch.
Yes.
Where everybody, after a while, is bored with looking after them and goes out there and throws some food in and goes away. I mean, that poor rabbit just sits out there dying of boredom and loneliness.
More so than a cat would. You could.
Oh, yeah. For sure. Cats are loner animals in many ways because they don't live in large groups.
Yeah.
But a bunny does suffer from, yes, it's very sad.
I think Carl has a question for you.
Oh, yes. My question, which you partially answered, was about the grooming of the animals. And of course, so important not to pick them up because they think they're... being predated upon, but also that distinction between animals like the cat and the rabbit with how their eyes are positioned. And that's so interesting. Maybe you can just tell us that.
Yes, well, rabbits being prey look like horses. Their eyes are on the side of their head, so that more so they can see things sneaking up behind them. Whereas a predator animal like a cat and a dog, their eyes are like ours. They look straight ahead, and they don't see as well beside them, but they're hunting species. I guess we are, too. Mm-hmm. So you look ahead, and you have binocular vision, which means that you see very well forward. Whereas rabbits don't have really great eyesight in front of their nose. In fact, they don't like being chucked under the chin or having hands come at their face. A lot of people shove their hand in the rabbit's face for it to sniff their hand like you would a dog, and they don't see that coming, and they don't like it, and you might get bitten because that is a very bad way to approach a rabbit.
Oh, interesting.
If you want to pet a rabbit, you pet them from above. You pet their forehead and their ears back on their back and stroke them with the fur. You come down on them and pet them. You don't shove your hand into their face.
Mm-hmm.
And most people are always doing that. Here, sniff my hand, and they poke their hand at the poor rabbit's face. And some of rabbits, of course, just like any other animal, are very placid and calm and easygoing, and they don't care, but others will be very startled. And some might bite because this thing suddenly is in their face.
Now, Marge asked you about the different types of rabbits. I know in the desert in Utah, I was walking in the desert there, and these rabbits had enormous, little brown bodies, but they had enormous ears. And I read afterwards that they have these ears as a mechanism, as a cooling mechanism.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's about the only way rabbits have to cool down is they have a lot of veins in their ears, and their ears are very thin, and so their ears radiate heat, and they also get cold, very cold if they're really cold. But rabbits don't have any pads on their feet to sweat like dogs and cats do, and they can't pant. And heat will kill a rabbit far faster than cold will.
Interesting.
So people worry about them being cold outside, but baking in the summer heat is far more dangerous for them. If they're out of the wind and the rain and they have somewhere snuggly, it doesn't even really get cold here for rabbits.
I see.
As long as they're not shoved out there suddenly after being in 80 degrees, you know, if they acclimatize. My rabbits go out to play every day in pens, and then they come in, you know, towards the evening when it's getting cool. And they're used to going in, just like your cat goes in and out, right? They're used to that.
Yes.
That's fine. But they should never be put out in with no protection, so they don't have somewhere snugly to go, or with the sun just beating down on them, or the rain coming down on them. Rabbits will sit in the rain. They just sit out there, and they don't really care. But they can hop in, you know, and get out of the rain, then they will when they want to, just like your dog or your cat.
Uh-huh, I see. Now, I do want you to tell us what would be the ideal home in which to place a rabbit, so people have an idea of if they're interested in getting a rabbit, whether or not they would be a suitable adopter.
Actually, the best home, the homes we really like to find are mature people with their own place to live. If it's rental, that's fine, as long as pets are allowed. People without small children, unless if they've had rabbits in the past and they understand that how careful the interaction between small children and rabbits has to be, that's okay. Mm-hmm. But rabbits are not good pets for children, and especially small children. We like someone who has enough income to pay the vet care, because rabbits can have quite high vet care, especially as they age. Mm-hmm. They also need vets that are particular to the rabbit species, not just any vet, and so the bills can be a bit higher. We like people who are going to understand that it's a 10-year commitment. So, for instance, there's people who turn pets into the SPCA who are here on a student visa. And they went to a pet store and got a pet, and they knew they weren't even going to be in the country after 2 years. Mm. And then when they're going to leave the country, they turn the rabbit in. Well, you know, we're not going to adopt a rabbit out to somebody who knows they're not going to be here in 2 years.
No.
I mean, it has to be a permanent, as far as they can tell, nobody can predict some disaster, but they have to understand that it's a 10-year commitment of everyday care, and it's an adult responsibility, and it's somebody who has some income to put towards the pet. I am not a believer in that everyone deserves a pet, whether they can afford them or not.
No.
It's just not right. I mean...
Well, veterinary care can be very expensive. And yeah. are there a number of vets, quite a number of vets in the Vancouver area that do work on rabbits?
Yeah, there's quite a few. There's not as many as cats and dogs, but there are quite a few, and they're becoming more because rabbits are the third most popular pet in North America. So there's becoming more, but they are they do have particular needs, and you know some vets will say, "Oh, I see rabbits," but you know, seeing them and being experienced with them is two different things, so you have to be really careful.
Yeah. One other point that you made when we talked earlier was about rabbits in classrooms. Would you speak to that, please?
Oh, yes. Interesting you should ask that, because I've just had someone on Bowen Island who has rescued a couple of rabbits from a little private school there where they were really badly neglected. Rabbits are not good classroom pets, of course, unless the only exception is if they're the teacher's pets and that teacher brings them to the classroom either occasionally or even if it's every day and takes them home with them, and they're a calm, well-adjusted, you know, that kind of rabbit. To have one in a classroom that is just the kids can just get at it, and it's stuck in there every evening alone, and every weekend it goes home with a different person. That is just terrible. It's one of the worst things you could do to a rabbit. Some of those rabbits are so traumatized after a year of that they actually never recover.
That's sad to hear, but well, I'm glad you made the point.
It's a terrible situation, and classrooms just should not have... Most people who rescue animals don't want any animal in the classroom unless there's that exceptional, excellent teacher who has their own pets in there and is teaching the kids and is very careful with their own pets.
Good. Now, if some people would like to have more information about your organization or about the rabbits, would you give us your website, please?
Yes, it's www.vrra.org.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a phone number you can give out?
Yeah, it's 604.
Yeah.
612-7699.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
And we're always looking for volunteers too. For bunny cleaning and socializing and
financial contributions, because all of this work is expensive, isn't it?
Yes, our vet bills are thousands every year, and it's all by donation. And our rabbit supply store, of course, really helps. If you need bunny supplies, please come and see us.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Olga. It's really been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thanks for asking me.
Oh, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to an interview with Olga Betts, who is the founder and president of the Vancouver Rabbit Rescue and Advocacy. This is CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial. Now, perhaps we could have just a little bit of music, please, John.
Like a lover's soul upon the fields. Holly. Feel her body rise when you kiss her mouth among the fields of gold. I never made promises like it, and there have been some that I've broken. I swear in the days you left me walking fields of gold. You walking fields of gold.
Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices on CFR Radio 102.7 FM. At this time of the year, where many charities are sending out appeals, you might want to ask them about whether they have the seal of approval, which is called Humane Charity. Well, it's the Humane Charity seal has a little rabbit on it, and it's administered. The Council on Humane Giving is administered by the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. There's a group of about 5,000 medical practitioners who are members of PCRM.org, and they want to ensure that the charities that you are donating to aren't involved in, many of them are involved in vivisection, animal experimentation, and since its inception, this is the Humane Seal, hundreds of charities have received the seal, and they are studying the causes of birth defects, helping people with AIDS, diabetes, or mental illness, and it's without using animal research. And so if you want to have a look at which charities are involved, which you could safely donate to without contributing towards animal cruelty, you can go to humaneseal.org. And yes, and just closing off, I want to say that next week we will have Kelly Harris with us, and she will be talking about the best-selling book called Omnivore's Dilemma by M. Pollan. And it'll talk about a little bit about what koala bears eat. They only eat eucalyptus leaves. So many other interesting things coming up with Kelly Harris next week on Animal Voices.
Thank you for that, Carl. And thank you, listeners, for being with us today. We are heard at 12 noon every Friday. And Animal Voices is our show. And we would like very much to have you back with us next week. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird fly, blackbird fly, into the line of a dark black night.